As I mentioned last week, this text is a difficult text, and the difficulty of the text can be seen in part by the differences that brethren have with regard to what it teaches, and especially with regard to their specific practices. There are some who wear a covering of some type. When they worship God, any time that they are in assembly, others do not. And so the text discusses the wearing of head coverings, and there are different positions that are held with regard to what the Apostle Paul intends from the text, and the application that that has upon us individually, and those things cannot be disregarded. Though, as you know, in our Bible class this morning and the assembly that will follow, the large majority of women do not have a veil on their head when they worship. That should not be construed as a rebellious attitude in the sense that we're going to do what we want. Doesn't mean that the practice is defensible, though I obviously believe that it is. But a recognition of the fact that some have taken from this text and concluded that they are not required in worship assembly to wear a veil. And some take that same text and they conclude that they are required to wear a veil. And we want to try to discuss and establish what the truth is on the matter as best we can. Just to make note of that, there are basically... just a couple of views that are held with regard to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I'm just going to state them very quickly, and then we'll look at the verses, read through and look at them. Basically, the idea is that Paul is establishing divine law in this particular text. In other words, this is something that is required. And the context would determine if that were the case as to whether it is required of, let's say, the ladies in this congregation during worship assembly. There are several sub-views that are held if that position is taken, that Paul is establishing divine law. Some take the position because of verse 15, if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering, as indicating that if a woman's hair is sufficiently long, that that hair is sufficient as a token of subjection, and an artificial or piece of clothing as a covering would not be required. That's one position that is held. You'll notice in verse 4 of the text, in verse 5, we're told that every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head, that every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. Now, the word prophesy there as reference to inspired teaching. It has reference to inspired gifts. There are some who claim that Paul is establishing divine law, but that that law is not applicable in modern times because it was applied to a specific context, and that context was the use of spiritual gifts. Now, these positions, there are troublesome aspects to each of these, which is why, again, we have to kind of wade through them, because there are individuals who will hold different positions, and whether those are valid or not is something that we are going to try to determine, at least somewhat, but right now I'm simply establishing the position for themselves. So the idea is that that since women are not able to pray and prophesy today, and those who take that position would use the "and" as distributive, have reference whatever is true with regard to the prophesying is regard true with regard to the praying, which would indicate that the prayer would be one of the spiritual gifts. That is a prayer that is an inspired prayer, which would be an inspired proclamation, so that those both would be in consideration, which not only are women not capable of doing in our time, but men are not either, because that age of spiritual gifts has passed as we receive that which is complete, as indicated and prophesied in 1 Corinthians 13. So 1 Corinthians 11, as an admonition, is no longer applicable in congregations of Christians. The third position is, of course, in regard to Paul establishing divine law, is that God said a woman is to be covered, and every woman in every age is to be covered by an artificial covering or veil when they worship God. And we know of a number of brethren who hold that position. There are some in our area, at the very least, who hold that position. I know of some women in other congregations who do that as a matter of conviction and as a matter of conscience. And I would say that if a woman has such a conviction, that she ought to do so. We've already talked, I think, quite extensively in our discussion, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, making note of Romans 14 as well, that an individual is bound to do as their conscience requires. So if a woman does not feel at liberty to worship God without the veil, without the covering, then she certainly should. And in stating that, I would hasten to say that, please, nothing that I say today is intended to be a stumbling block to you or to try to convince you not to do what your conscience demands. So it should not be construed as such. The second basic position that is held is that what Paul was commanding Christians in this particular context is to avoid any action that would violate what is custom, long-established custom. And this, of course, is one that has certain caveats as well. One caveat would be that such customs must not violate God's law or God's will. In other words, to give you some parallels, one of the things that I had to learn as I went to India is that the customs of the Indians are different than our customs. There are certain things that are accepted as normal, as without any impropriety at all among Americans, and that are not intrinsically wrong, in no way violate the law of God, that would nevertheless be inappropriate in India. One of the things that I found out very quickly is that a hug is not acceptable. I thought that to be an interesting thing because Joshua Mahendranath's wife, Aruna, she made that very clear to me because of the relative ages, that it was unacceptable for a man, a Christian brother, to hug a Christian sister. And I told her that I'm not much of a hugger myself, but that is not something that is prescribed against in our culture, that is something that is relatively common. And then I asked her the question. I said, well, when you met Brother Holmes, Bobby Holmes, I said, you hugged him. And her answer basically was, well, that was acceptable because he is. And then she gave a word that she used, which was basically, he is an older man. This was a sign of respect to him because he was an aged individual. And there was a distinction that was made in their culture that to us might would be something rather peculiar and unneeded. Nevertheless, it was something that needed to be observed. I'll give you one other with regard to that. And I have to say that I'm somewhat limited, at least firsthand, because I haven't visited many cultures. But the second one is very, very hot in India. And in the pictures that we saw before going, we noticed the casual dress of those in India. And in fact, it was very common when individuals came into their homes, for example, they would remove their shoes. And so you had a whole bunch of barefoot people, which is peculiar to us. So we basically bought any clothes that we needed so that we could be comfortable and relatively casual to fit in. As soon as we got there, Josh took one look at what we were wearing, which was basically a golf shirt. And he said, that won't do. He said, when you preach, you have to have a dress shirt. Well, I didn't bring any dress shirts. So the first thing we did was go into purchase and bought three that I basically washed and rotated through that time and wore dress shirts because in preaching, you needed to have a dress shirt. Now, tie wasn't necessary, suit wasn't necessary, shoes weren't necessary, and it wasn't long. I went and baptized some people in the river, and my tennis shoes got wet, and they stayed wet the rest of the time. So I bought a pair of sandals. So, boy, being dark complected, having a beard, and and being barefooted, I fit right in with the Indians there. There's a picture of four of us, two Indian preachers, me and Bobby Holmes. And we all had sandals and beard and were dark complected. He was bald-headed and clean-shaven, light complected, and had tennis shoes on. So who doesn't fit in here? It was Bobby. I fit in just fine in that regard. But anyway, so there is a difference. And his basic statement is you have to have a dress shirt because you will not be respected, and what you say will not be heard if you don't have a dress shirt on as you preach. And so that was something that we did as a sign of respect for their culture. And so there's a principle that is involved here that I think is a valid principle that we need to keep in mind. As Christians, we are different from the world. We stick out as a sore thumb because of the convictions that we hold and our principles. However, there is no reason for Christians to be different just for the sake of being different. And there are individuals who will lose influence, lose the ability to be effective in the proclamation of the gospel simply because they want to be different for difference's sake and set themselves up as being so peculiar or different for no reason, not based on principles of righteousness, just so that they'll stick out and be different, that the world will not listen to them or heed them. We need to be careful about those things. But anyway, so those are the basic two basic views that are held, that it is an established law that's being, or a divine law that's being established by Paul, where Paul is commanding the Christians in Corinth to basically keep the custom of that day because of the significance or the importance of it, and that it's custom that was being commanded. And different people hold different views as to what my view is. Boy, it seemed to me it's somewhat a hybrid. And I hate to say that, but as I study through this, there are some things that I think are obvious and compelling that I want to go over. But it may be that some hold somewhat different views in this regard. So let's just kind of go through the material and we'll talk about it and discuss some of these things, and perhaps we can come to some conclusions as a result of it. Yes, Justin?
Could you address first whether it's specific to assembly?
That's one of the first points that I'm going to make, yes. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that as well. Both of those things are found in the context with regard to what is under consideration here. Is it the assembly that's under consideration? In verse 14, does not your nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor? If a woman has long hair, it's a glory? Teachings of nature, and we'll talk a bit about the practice that's even found in our society today concerning long hair and short hair with regard to the various genders. So those are some of the things to bring up and to talk about as a part of this, or maybe sub-points with regard to this context. Okay, let's begin by reading verses 2 through 16 of 1 Corinthians 11, so everyone will have the material before them. And we'll try to, again, establish some of these things. Now, he's been discussing some specific and what we might refer to as individual problems that exist in the church. And I do think that there is a change in the context to kind of allude to what Justin is indicating. He begins, for example, in verse 17, he begins to talk about the Lord's Supper. In chapter 12 through chapter 14, the use of spiritual gifts. Specifically, clearly, in both of those, the context is in the local assembly. So we know that praying and prophesying that is done, and specifically, the instructions regarding the prophesying especially, but the exercise of spiritual gifts that are found in chapters 12 through 14, that he is governing abuses in the assembly. And so my view is, this is what I believe to be the case, though again, when you take a position like this with difficulties, I understand that some disagree with it, there may be some problems that some have with the conditions. I do believe that the assembly is under consideration in 1 Corinthians 11 as well, in the first 16 verses. But we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into it. He states in verse 2, I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man praying or prophesying hath his head covered, having his head covered, dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. For that is one and the same, as if her head were shaved. If a woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man is not from woman, but woman from man. Nor was man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. For as woman came from man, even so man also comes through woman. But all things are from God. Judge among yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. But if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. Now, again, there are so many things to look at and so many tangents that we can go to in this regard that it's kind of difficult to know how to approach this and where to start. But there are a couple of points that I want to make to begin with. That might be helpful to direct us, and then we can chase the rabbits as we feel need to answer any questions anyone has. First thing I want to establish, and it's very clear, is the headship of man is indicated in the passage. And there are a number of arguments that are used with regard to this. Arguments that are repeated in different contexts in other places. For example, in Ephesians the 5th chapter. You'll remember that Christ is the head of the church, and just as Christ is the head of the church, the man is the head of his wife. And so there is this indication of hierarchy that exists in a number of places in Scripture. A violation of that is something that is unacceptable. It's interesting, as we've alluded to already, the Apostle Paul seems to be dealing with issues, some of which were present in letters that were written to him, or a letter that was written to him. 1 Corinthians 7 is an indication of this. It's believed that the second verse of 1 Corinthians 11 is an allusion to their protestations of faithfulness to his teaching. Otherwise, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense, because up till this point in time, he's been chastising them from departing from his teachings. After that statement is made, he chastises them for departing from his teachings. But here he says, I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions, just as I delivered them to you. And I believe it was Mike Willis in his commentary indicated that this was Paul's way of telling them, is that you're telling me that you do what I've instructed you to do, and I praise you for that. Now I'm going to give you an opportunity to make good on your word in this area. So, apparently this area was a problem in Corinth. Now, why would that be? Why would it be that women would begin to usurp authority and throw off tokens or signs of submission in any society? A legitimate question. It's a question that needs to be answered, because it is applicable certainly in our society today. We made reference as part of the context of this, an example of a young lady. Her name is Lauren King, who is, I told you about the preaching intern. Well, I found a little bit more information about her. She actually went to David Lipscomb University, and I didn't know there was such a thing as internships with regard to preaching. But apparently, as we adapt the language of Ashdod, there are churches that began these kinds of denominational sectarian practices. And so she's been loaned from David Lipscomb University, or assigned, to the Fourth Avenue Church of Christ in Franklin, Tennessee. and as the first female preaching intern. And I listened to a portion of her sermon, the first sermon that she preached, and it wasn't a sermon behind a pulpit. They had their, they at least had music stands. That's all I saw on the video. I don't know if they had instruments or not there, but they obviously had a praise team and all these other kinds of accoutrements of the denomination of Church of Christ. But she basically said two things of any great import. Number one, the Lord led her to this. So it was very subjective. Basically, regardless of what the scriptures say, she was confident in what she was doing because this is the direction that the Lord led her to go. And secondly, that she is very understanding of individuals that couldn't go there with her. Had absolutely no problem with those who are bound by tradition. And as a result of that, we're not comfortable in that. Fortunately, the 4th Avenue congregation in Franklin was comfortable with that. As a result of that, we can... And she wasn't striving to be condescending, but by nature, these comments are condescending. You know, we will be more than willing to, in effect, put up with those who are bound by conscience sake where they can't go there. But we are going to rejoice in this, and we're not going to have a problem with them if they don't have a problem with us. That's kind of the attitude that that was expressed. And I'm very much paraphrasing because she said it much more nicely than I did just then. But anyway, so this is something that is that's where some are going. And they basically explain away some of the teaching of Paul, 1 Corinthians 14:34, as an example of it. And there is a group in our society that basically wants to throw off the shackles that culture has put on women so that they can use their gifts to their fullest extent. Well, it seems like in Corinth, some of the women in that congregation were wanting to do exactly the same thing. In fact, just go over very quickly over to chapter 14. Just a few chapters over, and he addresses that in verse 34 of the text. But in the context of this practice, the use of spiritual gifts in the assembly, he says in verse 34, "Let your women keep silent in the churches. For they are not permitted to speak, they're to be submissive, as the law says. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their husbands at home. It's shameful for a woman to speak in church." So, where could this go? Well, I'll give you just an example. Oh, let me rephrase that. Where could this come from? I'll give you just an example of an argument that is used, and perhaps could have been the argument that the maybe some in Corinth were using. It's interesting. I was reading an article by, and this is in Politics, and the individual, the man in this article, he identified himself as a feminist. Now, when you think of feminism, the empowerment of women in our society, and you have many women who identify themselves as feminists, but you have maybe not an equal number of men, but many men as well who identify themselves as feminists. I'm not going to be able to say that word correctly today. So well, what does that mean? Well, it is a man who is in league with, in agreement with, those feminist principles that are being espoused in our society, politics, all that kind of stuff, culturally. And so they consider themselves feminists. Now, why was there a problem in Corinth? Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, women who are willing to do things that were casting off this idea of submission and the headship of man. And there had to be men who were willing to allow that in Corinth. So I think the problem wasn't just women who were leaving their position or place. There had to be men who were encouraging that and participating in that with them. For this particular problem to happen. Well, where would that come from? Well, there are two possibilities. One is mere willfulness, but the second is a misunderstanding of what the Bible teaches. There's a principle that is established in Galatians chapter 3 that we're very familiar with in verse 28 that is misused even today in churches to establish this principle of a woman's participation in worship. In verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave, slave nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And so there is absolutely no doubt that what the Apostle Paul states there in verse 28 is true, but it must be understood in this proper context. It is having reference to the relative privilege that we attain in regards to our standing with God. If we are in Christ, we are Christians. If we are in Christ, we are redeemed. If we are in Christ, we are saved. And there is no distinction that is made with regard to culture, gender, or relative position in society. Now, having said that, as you look through the entirety of the New Testament teaching, not just the Old Testament, the New Testament teaching, you do find differences that continue to exist between Jews and Gentiles culturally, between slaves and masters, and certain responsibilities that were theirs under the New Testament covenant. This, things that they were to discharge. Philemon be an example of this, as well as husbands and wives, men and women. So it doesn't impact every aspect of the Christian's existence. In other words, it's not all right for me to say if I am a bondservant, okay, I've become a Christian, so I no longer have to accept the authority of my master, the master-servant relationship. Or a woman that says, I'm a Christian, so now I do not have to submit to the authority of my husband. Or an individual who is a woman to say, I'm a Christian, I have the same privileges, we're all one in Christ Jesus, so I can preach just as well as a man. It's disregarding what other scriptures teach. But perhaps that principle that the Apostle Paul espoused in Galatians chapter 3 had been taken by them to say that we have the right now to participate in these things. And so what he's doing is indicating to them that there are limitations. And the reason for that, the reason for these limitations, goes back to the concept of the submissive place that the woman has. And as he does in other places, he indicates the reason for that. You'll notice in verse 3, to start off with, verse 3, order of subjection. So I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is man, the head of Christ is God. Now, just as an aside, there was an interesting point. I forget the commentator that made this, which commentary I'm reading in this regard. I thought it was really, really good. In verse 3, you'll notice that the order is a bit out of what would be the natural order. You would, perhaps, if you want to go that direction, you would say that the head of Christ is God, the head of man is Christ, the head of woman is man. Or if you were to go the other way, the head of woman is man, the head of man is Christ, the head of Christ is God. But he puts it in a different order. Well, why is that? He says, verse 3, I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. I think that it's interesting that he establishes at the very beginning the submissive nature of the man's relationship to Christ. And just a point that could be made from this, if not for any other reason, I think it's germane and appropriate, and it's one that's made in Ephesians 5 as well, is that we should not construe the position of headship as authoritarian and as permissive as men in a congregation. Authoritarian in the sense that my way or the highway mentality, because nowhere in Scripture is such headship indicated. Christ has all authority. We're going to talk about my way or the highway. Christ is the only one that has the right to say that in the New Covenant. Elders have a servant's heart as they serve in the capacity of oversight. Husbands are to love their wives. So that authoritarian aspect of that should not be present, and of course we are to concern ourselves as Christ showed love for the church and giving himself for her, shedding his blood as a purchase price for the church's redemption. That concept of headship is the appropriate one, and it may be that in that verse 3, very quickly the submission of man is established here as well. But there is a hierarchy that is established here. It's established in this text. It is established with regard to, in verse 9 of the text, the creative hierarchy that exists, the process. Man was not created for the woman was created for the man. And then the third argument is from nature, that is found in verse 14 and 15. Does not even nature itself teach you with regard to a man having long hair? It's a dishonor, because it is a covering. But man is not to be covered, as he is the glory of God, as indicated in that. Woman is to have that covering, so nature tells. So there's at least three rules, or three arguments that are made. The hierarchical headship that is appointed by God, it is something that is from the process of creation to be so. And by the way, that means that it's not a cultural thing, this headship of man over woman. It's not a cultural thing, but one that is a part of God's design. And then nature itself with regard to the token. Those three things indicate the headship of man. So as we establish that, we need to recognize that whatever it is that these women were doing, they were throwing off this acknowledgement of the headship of man and what they were doing. They were leaving their proper place, is what they were doing. And that's what made this wrong. And that remains the case in every time. There are principles. Let me just say, Jerry. Two examples to make. First one is Lauren King, that example. I read a number of years ago a lecture that was at Abilene Christian University, where the speaker, and I believe it was Rick Ashley, some of you may be familiar with him, he was the pulpit minister at the Richland Hills Church for a while. But he basically said that as long as a woman does not usurp authority, that she can preach. You think about that. As long as she does not, and if, in other words, she's not preaching in an authoritative manner, that she can preach. But what's not understood is that the preaching itself, since it is a shame for a woman to speak in the assembly, the preaching itself is, by definition, a usurping of authority. It cannot be otherwise in that regard. So he would advocate women being able to preach as long as they're very humble in their approach. And in that regard, the opposite extreme. I was watching a YouTube video of a singing group, an acapella singing group, and they were singing a hymn, a Christmas hymn. Big quotes there, air quotes, Christmas hymn. In a church building. That wasn't really an assembly, but I thought that it was something that was rather telling, because these men were really trying to seem to be very. Humble and sincere in what they were doing, and two of them had very long feminine hairdos, and the third one that had a short hairdo, he was wearing a cowboy hat in the building. Now, this is something for some of the young men to consider, especially because I've seen this a number of times recently among Christians, and it's not a matter of willfulness on their part, it's simply a matter of not considering these principles and not being mindful of them. Is that baseball or golf hats are very popular in our society today. Individuals who are getting together at a singing or prayers and those kinds of things being offered, that their heads covered. And with regard to those things, it's a covering of the head. And they don't do it, they're not thinking about it. But that's something that in our culture, certainly, there's a reason why you take a hat off before the singing of the national anthem. Or take the hat off before the Pledge of Allegiance, and you take your hat off before you say a prayer to God. It's a matter of humility, and there's another term that respectfulness that you have in that regard, and sometimes that's ignored. It's a shame when that is the case. I remember in Crescent Park in Odessa, a man came in and he had a hat on, and Brother McDonald asked him to remove his hat, and said, I'm not going to take my hat off. And he said, well, then you're welcome to leave. And asked him to leave, because it was very disrespectful of our customs and what we did as part of our worship. And he wasn't welcome if he was going to be so disrespectful and rebellious in that regard. And I appreciated him doing it. Yes, Jim?
Oh, yeah. We were talking about her preaching, as long as she didn't do it usurping authority. And I'm not in favor at all of women preaching, but how could anyone preach and preach the word and not be authoritative?
Yeah.
It's a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That's a very good point. Yes, sir.
Let's go back to, you made that one point about doesn't nature itself get a little more specific. What does that mean? Does that mean it's natural? Nature says it means it's just natural for a man to have short hair and a woman to have long hair?
Yeah, well, see, that's problematic in this regard. So let's just talk about that for a few moments. Let's go ahead and go down to nature in verses 14 and 15. Does nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him, a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her? Nature teaches us something about hair. What does it teach us? Well, I can look in this congregation, and the ladies have longer hair than the men. Now, why is that? Well, nature has a part to play in it, certainly. Because I also see a lot of bald men in this congregation, and I don't see any bald women. I'm not saying that it's not possible for a woman to go bald, because it certainly is. And it's not possible for a man to retain his hair up until the time he dies at a very old age, because he certainly can as well. But nature has a part to play in this. Now, as far as does that mean that it is impossible for men to wear long hair? Of course not. Some men can have luxurious, lengthy hairdos, and they're very capable of it. Anybody who looked at the glam rock in the 1980s would see that. That was an unfortunate problem when I was in school. Long hairdos were very popular among young men. But what you have is, in this particular context, an idea of gender that's contained here. And this is something, and what he's arguing is from what nature or what you see around you. What you see around you is masculine and feminine. And you know, say, well, what's the limit? What's the line? What's that kind of stuff? That's not the point that he's making here. He's indicating that you have those who are masculine, you have those who are feminine. Part of that identity is hair. For a woman to seek to be masculine, it is something that is dishonorable to her. It is shameful to her. In fact, when he talks about the fact, with regard to her cutting her hair, having her hair short, might as well be shorn or shaven. The shearing. Thank you. I'm really struggling with that. The shearing of hair in that culture was a sign of either mourning for the woman, was a sign of either mourning or of humiliation. And it was a woman, for example, in ancient cultures, many of them, who was caught in adultery, that her hair would be sheared or shaven, one of those two, completely bald or close cropped as a sign of humility. It was also something that was common that prostitutes had their hair shorn. And so what he's indicating here is a part, again, an aspect of the culture of the day, certainly, that it was inappropriate for women to have their hair short and men to have their hair long. So the statement the way that I would put this, if I were to seek to explain it, is that if it's inappropriate for a man to wear his hair in such a way as to seem feminine, to strive for femininity. Hey, you guys get up here and try this. Femininity, okay? And conversely, for a woman to seek to become more masculine and put off femininity and by shearing her hair or by the way she dresses or whatever, that's a shameful thing as well. And I think what the Apostle Paul is very base is doing here is saying, hey, there's a difference between men and women, and each have their place, and it's wrong for a Christian to try to put off their place and try to go the other way. You know, we see this, it's especially the case, what do you see with regard to the homosexual lifestyle? Feminine men and masculine women. It's a perversion. And you see that prevalent in that particular part of our society today. So anytime that is there, you crossed over to that side where you're looking feminine because of your hairdo, or your dress, or your demeanor, such effeminacy is something that is deplorable to God. And for a woman to cross over to where she is seeking to be masculine or to be seen as masculine, then that's inappropriate as well. Yes, Justin.
So you're dancing this line between cultural and and non-cultural. I'm not really following where you're landing on it. But
I'm not landing yet.
Well, it's true. You're talking about the, you know, he's making references to the shorn women that were either humiliated or annoying. But it seems like his natural argument is trying to take culture out of it. He's trying to talk about, you know, here nature says it, creation says it, these are things that are outside of any given culture. Of course, if you go look at various given cultures, there are very much enormous differences in what's considered the cultural norms. And,
yeah.
And plenty of cultures where long hair for men is completely appropriate.
Yeah.
And I've heard sermons that draw lines, kind of like we have drawn lines on modesty from shoulder to knee and such, that have drawn lines on hair, basically saying that a woman's hair needs to be shoulder length to be appropriate and other things like that. And one sermon that even brought out inches, which is kind of interesting, because you take my children, for instance. Zoe's got pigtails right now that are, I don't know, 8 inches long or 6 inches long. But if you comb her hair out and you straighten her hair, it goes down past her knees. Well, what does that mean when Jason's sporting one of his mini afros? That means that he's sporting hair that's about 10 inches long. Now, I think a lot of people in here, if they were, a lot of the men in here, if they were sporting 10-inch long hair, then people would start to have problems with that. So, it's not consistent to it. How we treat things as far as length, so maybe it's consistent in how we treat things as far as whether they're considered points of femininity. Now, I can grow my hair out 10 inches, and I'll tell you right now, it might not even make it to my shoulders. It just kind of sticks out on my own throat when I'm at that point. And so is that feminine? Probably not. But if we tie it down into the culture, then the question becomes, how does the church change as society changes? So you look at something like the head coverings. Well, there's a Church of Christ in Corinth today, right? Do they wear head coverings or not? I don't know. But let's assume for a minute they don't. So that means that at some point, the culture at large changed, and then the church followed suit. But at what point do they follow suit? Because you go to a Rangers game today and you have the national anthem play, what percentage of the people take their hats off? Has the cultural point changed on that? Is it not considered disrespectful to have a toque for a man to wear a hat when something like that happens in the culture? Does that mean that the church needs to change? You look at Dilbert.
Well, is it
Dilbert wore a suit, a shirt and a tie, and now he wears polo shirts. Why does that happen? Because that's what's happened in culture. I've never been asked to wear a tie at work. I've never been asked to wear a button-up shirt.
No, I understand.
The culture's changed.
Yes. Yeah, but isn't the Apostle Paul dealing with that somewhat in this particular text, as he's indicating, if indeed this argument is culture, that Christians are not, let's put it this, Christians should not be the vanguard of culture. Just to give, and I'm giving you a quick answer to your question, but we don't have much time, so we'll address this because I do want to. I want to basically conclude this section by giving what my view is. And he's right. I was tap dancing around the part. I'm trying to kind of establish principles to tell you what I think instead of saying what I think and then having to answer people saying, "Well, it couldn't be that because of whatever the case may be." I want to give you my rationale. But I think, as I indicated early in the discussion, Paul commanded Christians to avoid any action that would violate long-established customs, providing those customs did not conflict with God's Word. That was one of the positions taken, and that's the custom position. And I think that is the case. Not everyone thinks, to use your illustration with regard to taking your hat off with singing the national anthem, not everyone thinks that it's disrespectful to leave your hat off. But there are an awful lot of people that still do. Now, it may reach the point to where it becomes disrespectful to take it off. Now, let's just give you an example with regard to prayers offered in Talmudic times among the Jews, Jewish men. In order for a Jewish man to pray, what does he have to do? He has to cover his head. That's what the little yarmulke or yarmulke or whatever you call it is that's on the back of his head. Is a token of submission as he offers up prayer to God. Submission to God as he offers up prayer. An individual in their culture that doesn't have that covering then he is not showing proper submission. So the culture changes. But right now, in that regard, when you leave your hat on during the singing of the national anthem, there are an awful lot of people, both your age and older, and maybe even a few younger, that think it's disrespectful.
An awful lot, like 50%?
I don't know.
20%?
I think it'd be more than 50%.
In this congregation, it'd be much more 50. But,
well, that's kind of what I'm talking about.
And we'll talk about that in principle a little bit later, because I recognize, as you, the customs change in that regard. But I do think that it's problematic for a Christian. Let's say for a Christian to do something. Well, me going over to India, for me to say, well, I'm an American Christian, so I'm going to go over there. And my culture is different. I'm going to wear what I want to wear. And there's nothing wrong with it. And try to teach them that. I'm not going to be effective. I'm going to offend people. And that's disruptive to my purpose in striving to share the gospel with them. So we've got a problem in the church of Corinth, because these women, while they were doing, at the very least, were offending and causing problems in the church by what they were doing. And he tells them they're not to do it. So if it's a matter of if it's simply a matter of custom in regard to that, then what they're violating the custom is something that's causing problems, he says, stop doing it. And we've got to talk about, what happens when we're talking about it. My view, as we draw the list to close, just to let you know so you won't go away thinking he's not wanting to tell you at all. There are two points that I have. I do believe that it is a matter of custom, the custom that was practiced and was universal at that time. But I also want you to notice the statement of verse 10. And then we'll talk about this. Let's give you something to think about. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. The word authority there does not have reference that she needs to put the veil on so that people will recognize that she is subject to that authority. That's not what's under consideration here. That token or symbol that's under consideration. It's a different term entirely. This is authority, exousia. This is authority that she has. This veil is a symbol of authority that she has as a woman. And this shows people that she has this authority. And so the principle that I would establish here is that there are times when a woman, because of inspiration with regard to prophecy, to give that specific example, that this is a plot that she has power and authority that's been given her to God to do something that normally a woman would not do. But since she's given this divine authority, she needs to have a symbol of that authority so that there will be that recognition on the part of individuals that she is keeping her place of submission, that she's not exalting herself, but to be an indication that what she is doing has that divine approval. And so I think there is a specific reference to a woman taking a leadership role. Now, whether it's in the assembly or not, and this is a problem with this position that I recognize, because in 1 Corinthians 14 it says don't do it in the assembly. So there's part that we want to discuss in regard to that. But I do think it's somewhat customary in regard to the actual wearing of the veil, but that there is a specific reference to women who are engaging in activities that could be construed as leaving her proper place. That in doing that, in this time, she needed to ensure that she put the veil on before she did it. In other words, it wasn't something that was done as a matter of course, but as she took this position or place. That's kind of where I'm going to go with the topic.
Very quickly, and the words on her head tied directly into the angels, which I'll bring in next time.
Okay, we'll talk about that next week. Thank you very much for your kind attention. We'll finish up with this study next week.